And welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Stephanie Domingo.
And Tux Lerzel.
I come to you from North Canton, Ohio, where I am recording on land belonging to the Kaskaskia Nation.
And I'm coming to you from Detroit, Michigan, where I record on land belonging to the Ottawa, Potawatomi, Wyandot, and Ojibwe Nations.
Nailed it.
Uh-huh.
All of these nations are some of many still very much out here doing their thing, and we'd like to acknowledge that. Mm-hmm. This is the mini-sode where we, you know, we talk about whatever we want because we don't have a format. This is living that format-less life out here.
Format-free.
Yes.
Format-free is the way to be.
Tis.
Words to live by.
So what are we talking about today?
So today I am going to be talking a little bit more about the rebellion in Detroit. But I'm going to be talking about something very stupid and political that happened.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah.
I love it.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
So yeah, last week I talked all about the uprising in Detroit during the long, hot summer of 67. And today I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about the decision to send federal troops into the city to help put down the rebellion. I wanted to talk about this last week. I had it in my original outline, but there's already so many moving parts to that story, and this part of the story deserved a little bit of its own discussion, and I knew that was just going to make an episode that was already too long even longer. So last week I mentioned that President Lyndon Johnson agreed to send federal troops into the city of Detroit after Governor George Romney asked for help.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Old mom jeans dad.
Yes. Yeah. Mittens' dad. So what I didn't mention was that for political reasons, Johnson hesitated before he agreed to send federal troops into Detroit, and that the rebellion might have actually ended at least a day earlier if he hadn't waited. Lives could have been saved. Homes could have been saved.
Yeah.
So many people lost their homes because of this, and Johnson was just kind of like, you know.
Trash.
Imagine that. So in my research about this, a lot of people want to sort of put the blame or at least point to the war in Vietnam as one of the reasons that Johnson might have hesitated. Johnson was really focused on his reputation and the way he was being seen, especially by the media and young people. He was worried that young people hated him.
He wanted to be popular.
Yeah. I mean, don't they all? They all do.
Oh, so sad.
Yeah.
Teens are never going to like you.
You're like, an old man.
What?
Yeah. So he was worried that young people hated him because of the war. I mean, they did.
Yeah.
There were demonstrations daily across the whole country, and he knew what was going on. He didn't like it. He was pissed that he was unpopular.
He didn't have like a Fox News to like protect him from the truth.
Totally. Well, I mean, I'm sure that the media did kind of side with him, but that didn't stop young people from being like, fuck that, you know? So he was worried that this sort of like anti-war movement would call him a warmonger and would, quote, charge that we cannot kill enough people in Vietnam, so we go out and shoot civilians in Detroit.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it seems that there were even more cynical reasons for waiting to make this call to send in these federal troops. The fact was that there was going to be an election in 1968, and LBJ had his eye on a third term as president.
What?
because he was not elected to his first term and didn't serve a full term, he came in because JFK was assassinated. Yeah, he served less than half of a term. The first term was less than 2 years. So the 22nd Amendment did not disqualify him from running for another term.
Wow.
So he was going to. He wanted to be president for another full term and planned to run. But then, you know, so eventually he realized that he didn't really have the support, that he was so unpopular that he wouldn't win. So in the sort of early year or early months of 1968, he ended up dropping out before it really got big enough. Mm-hmm. But in 67, in the summer of 67, he still thought that he was going to run and still thought he had a really good chance.
Got it.
At the same time that he was thinking about running for president, and kind of, I think a lot of people just took it for granted that he was going to run, and people were like, it's going to be LBJ versus a Republican. One name that was rising to the top of the list to run against him was Michigan's Republican governor, George Romney.
Amazing.
So earlier in 1967, LBJ had offered military assistance to both Governor Brown of California to put down the rebellion in the Watts area of LA and to Governor Hughes of New Jersey in putting down the uprising in Newark, New Jersey. Both of those governors were Democrats. And LBJ actually called them to offer his support, to offer the support of federal troops before they ever asked. He called them, was like, hey, I see you got some problems. You want some help? We got this. But no such offer was ever extended to Governor Romney in Detroit, despite the fact that, like, Mayor Kavanaugh was a big fan of LBJ's and, you know, Detroit was getting all this money from the Great Society Initiative. And, you know, Kavanaugh was like, of course, LBJ is going to help us out here in Detroit. But no, that didn't happen. Governor Romney decided to call the White House himself after midnight on Monday morning. So like the rebellion started in the really early hours of Sunday. And about 24 hours later, that's when Romney called LBJ's White House to be like, hey, shit's going down. We could use some help. What do you guys think? And he basically got a political cold shoulder. They were new phone. Who's this? So eventually, LBJ sent his personal envoy, Cyrus Vance, to Detroit to act as his liaison. And after touring the city with Romney and Kavanaugh, Vance was like, well, doesn't look too bad to me. Mayor Kavanaugh, who is like loved the Johnson administration, was like, usually the city isn't burning.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck? What is wrong with you? Yeah.
Too many black people.
Yeah. So finally, after some urging, the White House told Romney they would only commit to sending in troops if Romney issued a state of insurrection in Michigan. Johnson tried to say that because of the Insurrection Act, that he wasn't legally allowed to send troops into another state without this. But that was complete bullshit. Is that what they
bought in Newark? What's,
no, oh, not at all.
Okay. Weird.
Nope, that never happened. So, yeah. So it's complete bullshit. And Romney was like, no, I'm not doing that because issuing a state of insurrection would nullify most people's insurance policies. So all these people that are losing their homes to fire wouldn't be able to file claims for their losses.
Oh, no.
So I'm not fucking doing that.
Yeah.
But then he was like, y'all still need to fucking send troops out here and help us. So figure it out. So instead, Johnson insisted that Romney had to issue a statement basically saying that, like, he had lost control and needed help from the president.
Okay.
Basically, he had to, like, publicly admit that he was a fuck up and that President Johnson was going to save his ass.
Okay. So Johnson needed some good press or something.
Yeah. And to make Romney look bad because he was going to be his. Yeah. So then, finally, Romney was like, all right, I'll whatever the fuck you say, whatever you need me to do, I'll do it.
Yeah, he's like, and also like, I want to slap you with my dick real quick.
Yeah, exactly. Totally. Yeah. Jumbo's on the scene. So then President Johnson went on TV to announce that he was sending U.S. troops into Detroit. And during his announcement, he mentioned Governor Romney 14 times in this televised address, constantly talking about the, quote, clear, unmistakable, and undisputed evidence that Governor Romney of Michigan and the local officials have been unable to bring the situation under control.
Wow.
Yeah. One Johnson aide recalled, quote, Johnson wanted Romney to publicly admit that he could not maintain order. Romney balked at this for hours. Finally, Romney made a statement which was close enough. Johnson then went on TV to announce that he was sending troops to Detroit. He made such a point of Governor Romney not being able to manage things in Michigan that it seemed too political to me. There seemed to be a certain pleasure on Johnson's part in saying that Romney can't maintain order in Detroit.
Okay.
So, yeah, so that's finally Johnson was like, all right, I'll send you some troops. I'll help you out as long as you admit that I'm better than you and you don't know what you're doing and I do. I'll send you some help. So then he finally sends troops, but then he makes them sit at Selfridge Air Force Base for 12 full hours before he actually deployed them.
What?
Because he was hoping that and it would all blow over and he wouldn't have to do it. They were sitting there on an Air Force Base for 12 hours.
Wow. That's terrible.
Yeah. But eventually they, you know, they got into the city and things calmed down. But like, are you fucking kidding me, dude?
There was no reason like, for all of that.
Yeah. So I think this is a good time to take a little break. We'll be right back.
Cool.
So cool. All
Natalie.
And I'm Cass.
And we're the hosts of Shared History,
a comedic history podcast exploring the stories of the often overlooked or underrepresented.
The people and events your history books may have glossed over, whitewashed, man-washed, or left out completely.
From the Mayan creation myth to the Deaf President Now movement of the 1980s.
From ancient scientist Avicenna to first female principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, Wilma Mankiller.
If you saw it in a footnote once,
or have never heard of it,
we are here to share it with you.
Join us in a rotating guest list featuring scholars, writers, teachers, entertainers, entrepreneurs, subject matter experts, and more.
Tune in to Shared History on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, you know the drill.
And follow us at Shared Pod on Instagram and Twitter.
And as always,
share you later.
We're back. That story, this like political fucking chess game that nobody asked for and nobody needed, is basically the story I wanted to tell today. But I just have a little bit more I want to say about snipers.
Ooh, yes. Oh my God. Stephanie. I'm so excited for this.
So unfortunately, I tried really hard. I could not find a lot of information on the snipers. Okay. I tried very hard.
I know that you did. Yeah.
Yeah. Stephanie was very skeptical.
It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. I mean, basically what it comes down to is that I couldn't really find a lot of information on who these snipers were, why they couldn't find them, how many there were. I found some documentation of specific people. One man was actually killed, and there's like a whole thing about where it was and how it happened. And there's like a diagram online that shows like where the police were firing from and where the guy's window was. It was actually like a block and a half from my house on my same street that this happened. But the guy was actually killed, and it was written after his name in the paper that he was a sniper.
Okay.
But I found a lot of like firsthand accounts of sort of just civilians and people in the city who sort of say like we had to stay indoors because there were these snipers and we didn't know where they were firing from and didn't want to get hurt.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, it sounds like what was really going on is that it was just some guys with guns that were fucking pissed off and wanted to shoot at the police. Okay. You know, calling them snipers is a bit of an exaggeration. It's not like they were these like highly trained marksmen that, you know what I mean?
I feel like a sniper, lying in wait. Yeah,
exactly. That's not what was happening. It was just guys with guns shooting at the police. Okay,
that makes more sense.
Yeah. But the media wanted to call them snipers because that has more power. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I did read a few people actually sort of theorized that some of these people may have been former vets, like Vietnam vets, who came back and sort of were trained on how to fire at a target without revealing their position and be able to get away before anyone found them. But they still wouldn't have had scopes and all this, you know, even if they were trained by the military, it's not like they were snipers exactly.
Yeah.
You know, basically, yeah, people were just sick and tired of being treated like shit by the police. And they wanted to use this rebellion as a way to sort of be like, how do you like it? Yeah. I'll fucking shoot at you. You know what I mean? But I don't know why more weren't prosecuted. I don't know why more weren't found.
Yeah.
But afterwards, after this happened, and it wasn't just in Detroit that this was happening. They were also, I think in Newark, there were basically guys with guns shooting at the police that the media labeled snipers. And the media was going nuts over this, saying
that there were... This was the era of the Black Panthers and just like trying to be like, look, Black people are dangerous.
Exactly. And that's what Johnson especially really wanted to try and blame the whole thing on these like Black power radicals and militant groups.
Yeah.
When all evidence essentially points to like this just being sort of like random guys with guns, not organized at all. But the media really freaked out over this idea of Black men shooting at white police officers.
Yeah.
So there were all of these, you know,
like
news
reports. Like the tables
reports.
Had been turned. Like, no, totally. We kill you.
Yeah. We can't do this. Yeah, yeah, yeah. News reports and newspaper articles, but like magazine spreads, full color magazine spreads of all these images of like white police officers like cowering, ducking and hiding behind cars and like behind trees and shit to save their own lives from these snipers' bullets. People like lost their shit across the country, and everyone was blaming the Black Panthers, even though they really had like nothing to do, or at least there's no proof.
Mostly they were just feeding school children, but
totally.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And so because of all this like hype over the possibility that it was these Black power groups and radical militants and all this stuff, Johnson, In the sort of final days of the rebellion in Detroit, Johnson met with the FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover, and basically told him that he had to find evidence of a national conspiracy behind these rebellions
were
happening across the country.
He's like, let me fabricate some real quick.
Yeah,
I have people embedded.
Yeah. But Hoover ended up admitting that there never was any like organized conspiracy to do this, that it was just happening on its own. And that's like that the report that Johnson had, you know, people investigate, and they're like, no, it's because Black people are fucking sick of being treated like shit and having to live in these horrible areas with the police like treating them like dogs.
Yeah.
This has nothing to do with
militant
groups.
I mean, the Black power movement was about self-defense against the cops. And like that is an act of aggression to, I guess, protect yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Ugh.
So even though Hoover ended up never finding any evidence of this, he used this like moment as his golden ticket to expand the FBI's counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO.
Ugh. Yeah.
He was like, oh, I just need more money for the FBI. Yes. I need to expand this. I need a bigger, better tool to like wage war on Black people and civil rights leaders.
I need
leaders.
To get the king of the militants, MLK.
Yeah. Yeah.
I need to try to get him to kill himself.
Yeah. Ugh. And so because of all of the reaction to what had happened and the way, especially the reaction to the way the media and the police reported on these snipers.
Yeah, I mean, it was an election era. Like this is crime.
Totally.
You know, this is their favorite narrative. It works though.
Totally. So the following year in 1968, Congress passed the Crime Control and Safe Streets Act. of 1968, which gave the FBI a 10% budget increase and helped increase legal protections for wiretapping and helped essentially, you know, sort of long-term lead to the militarization of police forces across the country.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thanks, Detroit.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't just Detroit, because this was happening all over the country at this point.
Thanks,
but Detroit was the
black militants.
The biggest one. Yeah, exactly. I mean, honestly, it's like, thanks police for pretending that there were hundreds of snipers all over the place. God. And it was just so dangerous for you. And then the media for being like, yeah, that's what's happening.
Well, the media takes police reporting as fact. Even
yeah, absolutely.
They prove time and time again that they are lies.
Totally. Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I love that. Yep. Thanks for the follow up. Yeah. I hope I don't come across as like too skeptical of all of the sniping in the last episode, because I'm just like,
no, I completely understand.
It just didn't make any
from.
Sense. And I was just like, this feels like the feds. Like, I don't know.
Totally.
I'm very, I get it.
Makes complete
suspicious.
Sense.
Because like this is
especially because
before.
Of COINTELPRO. Yeah.
Exactly. And how they they embed people in to cause chaos. And then that is how they get, you know, they crumble these organizations from within by planting agents of chaos who are just like there to start shit and to like be arrested, but like, you know, no charges ever are attached to these people. Yeah, that was really good though. Thank you for that clarification and for just bringing Johnson into it. It's always a good time when that man's involved, right?
I know. What a character.
What a character indeed.
I know. People want to love him because of the Great Society Initiative.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, he was doing a lot of good stuff, but he also was a piece of shit. I mean, he was a politician.
He can be more than one thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Most people are. So we want idols so bad. It's like, it's really sad to me. It's like, why can't these people just be men?
Yeah.
And like that be that. But
they're not beyond reproach.
They sure aren't.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Stephanie Domingo.
And Tux Lerzel.
Thank you to our new editor, our new audio editor, Dev. We could not do this without him. Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A thousand thank yous.
Thanks, y'all.
All right. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Beyond Reproach. Please note we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. A full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a written review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone who you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media. And make sure you follow us on Instagram, because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you're not driving. We also have a shop on beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We also have exclusive content on Patreon, where you can directly support the production of our show.